On the Record with Gavin Riley on News Talk.
We're joined in the studio by the Sinn Féin spokesperson for housing and TD for Dublin Midwest, Eoin O'Brien. Ordinarily when we would have someone like you coming in, it would be to discuss specific matters of the day. And I suppose this is matters of the day, but you're in reasonably unusually to talk about a new book that you've published, released in the last couple of days, called Defects: Living with the Legacy of the Celtic Tiger, which is obviously a very topical thing considering there's been so much coverage in recent weeks about mica and pyrite. Your book attempts to examine where the culture of allowing these problems to emerge came from. Without trying to spoil the entire book, what have you found?
Well, I suppose the book tries to do four things. I mean, the first is to tell the human story of families living with defects. So there are six families, four from Dublin, one from Clare and one from Donegal, who are interviewed quite extensively. And the first half of the book really takes you through their lived experience, from the excitement of buying their first home and the security and the stability that provides them, to the shock of discovering the defects, and then of course realizing that they have no comeback against the developer, that the state isn't really interested in responding, and where they're that leaves them all today. The second part of the book obviously names all the developers for the developments that are in the public domain and dealt with.
But then, and we know a lot of those. It's the likes of Priory Hall and Tom
Exactly. Fee. And you have, you know, Longbow Quay, and you have Beacon South Quarter, and you have Brunashanna, and obviously you have pyrite in Leinster and mica and pyrite in Defective Block in a series of counties in the Western Seaboard, most prominently Mayo and Donegal. But I suppose one of the things I really want to do is to ask the question, well, how is this allowed to happen? Mm. So I went back and I looked at the passage of legislation for what we call the building control regime. So that's the system for enforcing the building regulations that are there. And actually, the story is fascinating, genuinely fascinating, in the sense that back in the 1960s, when large numbers of people in Dublin were living in tenements, very dangerous, often those tenements collapsed and people were killed, the government introduced a local government bill, Planning and Development Act 1962-63. And there was a very small provision in that act to give the minister the power to create a building control regime, because one didn't exist across the state.
Okay.
Very little happened until the 1970s. And in the mid-70s, government published a draft building control regime. It was for an independent local authority-led inspection. So no matter what you were building, if you were a big developer or a small commercial or residential developer, there would be independent inspections by the local authority to make sure everything was being done in accordance with the rules. Industry trashed it. Both the Construction Industry Federation and an organisation at the time that represented architects, surveyors and engineers absolutely slated the thing, saying that it would add cost, it would delay output, and local authorities didn't have the staff.
And so what happened then? Did it just stop happening? Or like, was their trashing successful in stopping it happening, or did the inspections go ahead nonetheless?
Interestingly, the following year, the Law Reform Commission published a really important report, basically saying that defective buildings were actually a problem then in 77, and they wanted government to introduce a legal obligation on builders to build in accordance with the rules, right?
Okay.
That was also trashed.
There wasn't, until 1977, a requirement to build in accordance with rules.
What you had was, you had some standards, and then six local authorities did have bylaws to enforce those, but there was no comprehensive system that was there. And yet there was no statutory responsibility to build properly. And of course, the same people who trashed the department's draft building control regime trashed the report and recommendations from the Law Reform Commission. Everything then was put on hold. Nothing happened. The proposals were basically put on the shelf. What changed was the tragedy of the Stardust Fire in Artane in 1981 and the 48 young people who tragically lost their lives. And as you know, Gavin, the government of the day brought in Justice Keane to do a comprehensive tribunal of inquiry. Mm-hmm. And while that tribunal of inquiry report has been rightly criticised by the families, there is a really, really important section of the report where Justice Keane strongly criticises the then Department of Environment for failing to introduce the 76 regulations. In fact, Justice Keane goes as far as to say, if they had have done that at the time, if those fire safety regulations had been enforced at the time of the Stardust Fire, it would not have been as severe. He then says, you need to get these things introduced, and calls for them to be introduced within 3 months. Instead of doing that, the then Minister of Environment, Dick Spring, also the Taoiseach, brings a very detailed memo to Cabinet, and I released the details of that memo, I think, for the first time, basically rejecting Keane's recommendations, saying the Department of Environment had done nothing wrong, but also independent local authority inspections was not the way to go. He says almost exactly what industry had said in response to the department's earlier proposals. It would be too expensive. It would slow down the process of building much needed homes, and we can't afford to employ the local authority staff. So what happens then is the 1984 Building Control Bill is introduced. It takes from 84 to 92 for that bill to pass and the new regulations to be enforced.
So and it takes it puts 11 in place years after Stardust to actually get on the books.
So first of all, obviously, you have to remember the 80s, there was a series of general elections, right? Yeah. So one general election fell midway through the passage of the bill. The Fine Gael Labour coalition collapses, Fianna Fáil take over. But it's also very clear neither Fianna Fáil nor Fine Gael really think that this is a big priority, right? So the passage of the bill starts 84, the bill passes 90. It takes a year and a half then to get the regs in place and for them to be published in 92. The debates in the passage of that bill are astounding. So two small little anecdotes. There is Fergus O'Brien is the Fine Gael Minister of State, who happened to be the Lord Mayor of Dublin at the time of the Stardust tragedy. He introduces the bill.
And these being the days, by the way, for people who are confused by that, where there wasn't a ban on dual mandates, so you could be a councillor and a TD at the same time.
Exactly, and an MEP, in fact, at one stage. He introduces the bill, and he said that it's a system of self-certification, that industry will certify its own work. Bobby Molloy.
So decades after we had this idea of councils enforcing the standards, we finally have a rule introduced in the early 90s.
Industry does it itself. I know I'm kind of a little bit obsessed about building control because I've seen the enormous damage that it has done to families and their lives. But the Dáil debates are really remarkable. So two quick stories. Fergus O'Brien introduces the bill. Bobby Molloy is the Fianna Fáil Galway TD, who's their opposition spokesperson on environment and local government. He absolutely rejects the bill. He said industry hasn't been consulted. He said it's really, really bad. He said we can't support it. In response, the Minister of State says, oh, no, Deputy. This is exactly what industry asked to do. We consulted them. They didn't like independent self-inspection and they wanted self-certification. Forward a bunch of years to committee stage, Eamon Gilmore, one of the few TDs who rightly opposes this piece of legislation and does a really, really good job from the opposition benches. He has this exchange.
A Democratic left at the time.
Workers' Party at this point. And Pádraig Flynn is now the Fianna Fáil minister after the change in government. Eamon Gilmore gets up and says, if this bill passes, a rogue builder and a rogue architect can build a defective home. And if I buy that home, I have no comeback. Pádraig Flynn then responds by saying, I don't know why the deputy is so obsessed with rogue builders. I've never met any. And this is Pádraig Flynn, who the tribunal subsequently revealed had received thousands of euros. So Pádraig Flynn then responds and says, you know, I've never met them. And Gilmore says, well, I've seen quite a lot. To which then Pádraig Flynn says, well, in fact, if a builder builds bad buildings, they won't be able to get any future work. They have to trade on their reputation. What happens after the passage of this legislation, the introduction of the regulations? Economy emerges out of recession, biggest building boom in the history of the state. And as we know, thousands, if not tens of thousands of homes were built exactly as Eamon Gilmore had warned. And the families living in those homes, particularly for the likes of folks with fire safety issues or Mike and Pyrite, have very, very serious issues to deal with. And to date, government has not necessarily been forthcoming with the kind of 100% redress scheme that we need to see.
And we'll come back to that, I suppose. Well, actually, we'll come to it now, because I suppose the question, what is raised by all of this, that this might feel like it's ancient history or a little sort of like boutique parliamentary tour of previous debates. But this becomes germane when we're talking about current issues now. Like, even I don't want to portray that Longbow Quay and Priory Hall are in the past, but they're issues which are somewhat settled. You still have Pyrite and Mica, which are still existing now. And I suppose when it comes to the crunch, people will have every sympathy for the families that are impacted by Mica, and there's been lots of media coverage of it in recent months, but they'll sort of wonder why it's on the state, or where the state's responsibility comes in here, and why it might be up to the state to have to cover the full cost of redress for remedying those properties, for rebuilding them, when the state didn't build the property.
And it shouldn't be left to the state and the taxpayer to foot the full bill. But also, let's be very clear, the Construction Defects Alliance, which is a campaign network of homeowners who are affected by fire safety and water ingress defects, they're aware of about 90 developments across the state today that have serious defects that haven't been remediated. We also know, of course, that there are thousands of homes in Donegal and Mayo, and subsequently we found smaller numbers of homes in Sligo, Limerick and Clare with defective block. So today and tonight, there are people sleeping in badly built, unsafe, and as in the case of Donegal, homes which are literally crumbling around people. So the first thing is, is in the first instance, and there's a significant section of the book which is about what should happen now, both in terms of the redress as well as further reforms to ensure this stuff doesn't happen again. But in the first instance, the supplier of the material or the builder or developer of the shoddy work should have to pay. And where they are still trading and where they have an ability to do so, they should be pursued. But the reason why that story about the passage of the legislation is so important is because the government were warned, in particular by a number of opposition deputies and the Law Reform Commission and Justice Keane's Stardust Tribune report, that they had to have an independent building control regime. They were told if they didn't do that, things would be bad in the future. And the government ignored that advice. So the state has a responsibility here. They could have had a proper building control regime. They could have properly funded local authorities to have the kind of independent inspection regime that, for example, today exists up in Belfast in the north or other jurisdictions. So because the state ignored the advice, not just of other politicians, but the Law Reform Commission and Justice Keane's report, they have a responsibility to this too. And what I would like to see is a very significant redress scheme with a fund which is in part covered by industry. That's the insurance industry, materials industry and the building industry, but also by government. And if we look at the scale of the defects that are going to have to be addressed and the amount of money involved, the state is going to have to play its role. Phil Hogan, when he was the minister after Priory Hall, did look at the possibility of an industry levy on insurance builders and quarries to fund the original pyrite scheme for Leinster. The insurance industry sent him a very threatening letter that I got a copy of recently under FOI, effectively threatening to take the government to court if they pursued this. Phil Hogan backed down. And of course, the government then put the taxpayer on the hook for the full pyrite remediation scheme.
You either put the taxpayer on the hook or you charge a levy to builders, which means that all future properties become that little bit dearer, in the same way that we all pay a little bit more in our insurance for PMPA or the collapse of Quinn.
Exactly. And that's the blunt reality of it. But there are two things I would say. The first thing is, any other thing that you buy, if you go out to a shop today, Gavin, and you buy something and you take it home and it's defective, what do? You bring it back to the shop and you get a refund or you get a replacement. The only purchase that you don't have that opportunity is the biggest purchase of your life, right? Mm. And it's not just home purchasers. We have a large number of council properties that were built during the Celtic Tiger period, either owned by councils or approved housing bodies, that also have significant defects with all sorts of implications, health and otherwise, for the social housing tenants there as well. So first of all, homeowners who live in defective properties, where they did not cause those structural defects, should not have to foot the bill. And industry and the state, because they are both responsible, have to step in and fully fund it. It was done for Priory Hall. It was done for homeowners affected by pyrite and the foundations. It was done partially, although unsatisfactorily, for folks in Mayo and Donegal. So the state has already accepted it has some liability here. But if we're going to do this, let's do it properly, because the longer we kick the can down the road, not only the more expensive does it become, but the more traumatic for the families involved.
And that, of course, is one of the closing arguments that's made in the book, which is on sale now. But just because you happen to mention the role of approved housing bodies, and often when there's debate about the costs of building, one of the examples that you've often held up is the Ocúlán cooperative housing development in Ballymun. And that is contemporary because there was a piece in the Irish Times, I think, on Thursday, that a property that was originally sold as affordable housing for €170,000, which is unique in its own right because it's very difficult to build and supply any new housing for €170,000, was sold a couple of days ago for €325,000, which is an increase of more than 90%. There is certain clawback, but the buyer is still able to leave with a profit of almost €100,000. Now, everyone wants there to be affordable housing, and a lot of people would say if that owner is able to get rid of the property and make that profit, then fair play to them. But maybe there's always a question of moral hazard here, where if you're trying to make housing affordable for people, if you're trying to subsidise the housing that they buy, aren't you always leaving yourself open to this sort of thing, where someone who is able to avail of a scheme like this with the state's backing ends up quids in themselves afterwards.
Absolutely. And in fact, O'Coolan didn't want this kind of model to feature in their estates, but they were prevented from putting in place a proper measure to prevent it by the banks. The issue here is as follows. When the purchasers of O'Coolan houses buy those houses, they're not buying the full house. They're not paying the full market value for the land. They're not paying development levies. They're not paying
developers' margin.
The way it's set up is Dublin City Council provided the land for those houses at 1,000 euros a plot. That land was probably valued at the time about 30 to 35,000 euros a plot. The development levies and site servicing, etc., aren't paid. But there's a solution to this. You should not be allowed to do what's happened in that instance. It's not O'Coolan's fault. They didn't want this to work out that way, but government wouldn't put in the necessary mechanism. So here's how you do it. In future, all such affordable homes delivered by cooperatives, approved housing bodies, local authorities, when the person purchases it, they should purchase the house and not the land, right? So the land should remain in public ownership and there should be covenants attached to the land. There's no charge, there's no ground rent for the land. But the two covenants would be you get to live in that house as long as you want, you get to pass it to your kids and your grandkids, intergenerational security of tenure is really important. But you cannot sell that house into the private market and you cannot rent it into the private market. If at a future point in time...
You should have to sell it back to the cooperative.
If you want to sell it into the future, you should be allowed to do that. You sell it to another affordable purchaser at the future affordable purchase price, which would be the price you paid for it, indexing for inflation and home ownership. The two values of that is not only does the first buyer never get to make that windfall gain, but over time we would build up a stock of privately owned, tradable, but permanently affordable homes so that future generations of affordable purchasers would have those properties.
But who's responsible then for those safeguards not being put in? Because I know that like even back at the tail end of the Celtic Tiger when the Affordable Homes Partnership was trying to arrange affordable sales of long-term homes, there was still even at that point a clawback mechanism where you couldn't just flip the property a few years later and get to keep the lion's share. But that clearly hasn't happened in this case. So whose fault is that?
Well, it's not O'Coolan's because they wanted to have a different mechanism. But also, you see, a clawback doesn't solve the problem because a clawback...
a clawback would remove the incentive of someone trying to flip the property 3 or 4 years later.
The clawback is a clawback of the original discount that you didn't pay as a percentage of the market future market value of the home. So, of course, if house prices have increased as dramatically as they have, even by paying the clawback, you're getting the windfall. But there's a broader point here, which is it's not just the windfall gain of the individual. It's the fact that that affordable home is only affordable to the first purchaser. That should be an affordable home to every future purchaser so that future generations get the same benefit. Mm. We have a limited amount of public land and therefore it makes no sense. It's the same with council properties. It makes no sense where you're selling a home on that land to allow the possibility at the future that that goes into the private market. Let allow people have affordable purchase homes, but keep those homes permanently affordable for future generations. So that avoids the problem of the windfall gain for the first seller, but it also means that we never lose those homes into the private market.
Okay, but then it still doesn't really answer the question as to whose fault it is that that this one got through.
Oh, the fault is absolutely the government's. And keep in mind the current.
You would say that current, though, wouldn't
you? But it's important. The current affordable housing scheme that Dara O'Brien has introduced, which is modelled very, very closely on that of Owen Murphy, will allow this kind of thing to happen for all of the new affordable sale homes. Yes, there will be a clawback. It'll be a percentage of the future market value of the home. But where the market value has outstripped that, then there'll be a windfall gain. Let's keep affordable homes permanently affordable.
Well, on that note, and very briefly, because I'm running short of time, there's a piece on the front page of today's Business Post about how property funds have acquired what were once upon a time social housing developed by councils and have now found themselves renting those properties back to councils so that they're once again used as social housing, but without the state owning the property at the end and obviously having to pay private market rent in the meantime. Your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so this just confirms the insanity of our housing system. So the taxpayer pays to build these homes. Council tenants are able to purchase them, and tenant purchase is a good thing, and I support it. But at a future point in time, they can sell those properties into the market. They can be bought by institutional investors, as has happened in my own local authority area. And the institutional investors lease them back to the local authority at exorbitant prices for 25 years, and the state never gets to own them. So, interestingly, the same local authority is not allowed to buy those homes today. It's allowed to lease them at a high cost for 25 years, but is prohibited from purchasing them under the rule that Owen Murphy introduced a general prohibition on local authorities purchasing vacant properties back in 2019. Dara O'Brien amended that in August of last year. Local authorities can buy 1 and 4 bed vacants for the purposes of housing people or long-term emergency accommodation.
They can't buy their own previous housing.
No, and many of the houses, 33 such homes, not all council, some formerly private rental, have been long-term leased in South Dublin in the last 3 weeks. Many of those had social housing applicants in them on HAP and RAS. They were evicted for the homes to be sold to institutional investors to be leased back at a high cost to the taxpayer and the local authority. It's absolutely absurd.
On the same note, if you believe that someone who buys an affordable house should then be required to sell it on in a way that is permanently affordable, if you're in favour of tenant purchase of council housing, should that person be required, if they're ever selling, should it be actually be a rule that the council buys it back?
Absolutely. I've been arguing this for a long time. First of all, it should be sold back to the council, but given that that person would have bought it at a substantial discount, they should sell it back to the council at the discount rate, obviously index linked for inflation.
No doubt something that we might be hearing more about very shortly. In the meantime, Owen O'Brien, author of Defects, Living with the Legacy of the Celtic Tiger, and Sinn Féin spokesperson on housing. Thank you for joining us.
On the Record with Gavin Riley on News Talk